Well, great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the West Coast of Wisconsin today with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Reggie stops by every so often to talk about the Mississippi and what's going on there. You may have some stories about the river or places you like to visit on the river or along the river. I hope you'll join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd love to see your photos of the Mississippi and put those up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Reggie McLeod, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be back.
I tell you what, Big River has been covering the driftless area of the Mississippi River for, what is it, over 20 years, isn't it?
Almost 24 years, actually.
Oh, man.
I know.
Well,
by quick.
I tell you, you've got a great magazine, a great issue this time. But for those who aren't familiar with it, talk about what we find in each issue.
Well, we cover the Upper Mississippi River from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities, which includes the whole Wisconsin coast on the river. And we really cover everything. We cover the environment, recreation, wildlife, development issues, businesses, because all those things affect each other, especially on the river. And it's good to kind of show how they affect each other rather than trying to specialize, you know, trying to disconnect things that are actually connected.
Yeah, you wrote a great editorial in this edition of Big River about the changes that the cities and towns on the river have experienced over the years. Talk about those trends a little bit.
Yeah, I've been kind of worried. I'm concerned about climate change, of course, and the environment, but a lot of power plants have been closing in towns on the river or scaling back. And a lot of those are pretty small towns, and the power plants are often the largest or one of the largest employers in town. And Cassville had two power plants closed last year, and that laid off a big share of the workforce in Cassville. Alma had one of its two plants closed a couple years ago, and they're talking about closing a nuclear plant down in Illinois. That's a huge employer, and the Lansing, Iowa plant, which is just right across from Wisconsin, they've closed 4 of the 5 units at that coal fire plant. Mm-hmm. And then we did a story in this issue of a hundred and some years ago, there used to be a lot of people who made their living harvesting mussel shells from the river, and those were turned into mother-of-pearl buttons. And there were button factories in a lot of the large towns on the river, so it was a huge industry. And those were replaced eventually by plastic buttons. The plastic buttons on your shirt are probably made to look like mother of pearl still. Well, there was one of those button factories that was still open in Lansing, Iowa. And they had kind of evolved over the years, so they were basically putting buttons on the cards that are used to display the plastic buttons. But it was kind of the same company. It had been bought and sold several times and gone through a lot of changes. And they just are shutting down their factory in a few days and laying the employees off there. So my editorial, I was kind of looking at this and how difficult this is for a lot of these river towns, but also kind of seeing that we've been through that before. Muscatine, Iowa was a pearl button capital of the world. They had a huge pearl button industry there. And that's long gone. I mean, that ended early in the 20th century. And then Winona and La Crosse and a lot of the cities had huge lumber industries where these log rafts were floated down the Mississippi River from the northern forests when they were all being cut. And they sawed them up into boards, and a lot of them went out west to build the towns out west, as well as the towns along the river. And those shut down almost 100 years ago, pretty much all of those closed. So we've been through those cycles before, and we've always found other things to do. But it's going to be pretty tough, I think, for the next few years in a lot of these towns, trying to figure out how to replace those jobs, and some of them will probably shrink a little bit in the process of doing that.
Yeah. And there's a proposed, there are some proposed Minnesota DNR rules for development along the Mississippi that could have some impact for Wisconsin as well.
Yeah, it's, it's difficult. And that's why we write about development a lot, because a lot of development issues have to do with floodplains and water quality and, you know, trying to juggle the various interests that have to do with that.
Lynn from Southeast Minnesota called to ask if you've ever been to the Dam Bar or heard of it, D-A-M Bar.
Which one? There are a few Dam Bars. No, I think there's one in Alma, and I don't know which one. Do you know which one she was talking about?
No, she didn't say which one. She didn't leave that in the message, unfortunately. What are they like?
They're often in view of a dam. A lot of the dams on the river are next to a town, so you could sip your beer and look out the window and see a dam. Alma is the one that comes to mind first because, you know, the dam is right there and the lock is right there in the middle of town. And there's a Pier 6, which is named after its Lock and Dam 6, which is a barbecue joint that is right by the lock wall. In fact, you can sit there and have your lunch or dinner and see toes, you know, pulling into the lock. And I believe there's a dam bar in Alma as well, and a few other things named after the dam.
I love the photos from the story about the Alpunks.
Yeah, that was kind of fun.
Flotilla? How did that get going?
Photogenic bunch. Well, you know, there's a long tradition, I think, that probably goes back before Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer of kind of making homemade boats or rafts and floating down the river in search of adventure. And as well, there's also a tradition of people who want to paddle or boat or row or whatever the entire length of the river from Lake Itasca down to the Gulf of Mexico. And that seems to be increasing. And there's kind of a movement that's, over the years, there have been a few groups that left the Twin Cities in homemade boats. And just recently, a couple weeks ago, another group of people who appeared to be mostly in their 20s and 30s left the Twin Cities in homemade boats, headed for Winona, which is probably good. We have an active boathouse community here in Winona, and there have been a lot of people who have planned to paddle or sail the length of the river, and then they stop in Winona for a while and start hanging out with the boathouse community here. And pretty soon the leaves are turning and it's getting cold and they're still in Winona. So they can be easily distracted here if they, you know, especially if they're in their 20s and 30s. And it's a college town as well. So these guys, they're left the Twin Cities and their destination was Winona, which is so they're just resigned to that, I suppose. But, yeah, they have boats floating on barrels and a solar-powered canoe. And you wouldn't believe some of the contraptions that come into town. There were a couple young women that had a houseboat, and they had bicycles rigged up in the back of it so they'd pedal and turn a paddle wheel on the back. And I think if the current was, say, 4 miles an hour and they pedaled real hard, they could get up to about 5 miles an hour. And they were in their early to mid-20s, and so I was getting constant emails and pictures from middle-aged men all along the river who were kind of noticing them paddling by and taking pictures, and it was kind of fun. I think they made it down to the Quad Cities.
How many? Well, there were a lot of boats.
Oh, yeah.
And that flotilla.
Oh, yeah. I think there were at least a dozen, and I don't know if we have a real count. I'm not sure that all of them went the entire way either. But it seemed like it was about a dozen.
Lynn from Southeast Minnesota called back to tell you that it's the one by Fountain City. She and her husband visited the floating bar and loved it.
Oh, the floating bar right below the lock and dam, yeah. Yeah, that used to be I think it still is a fishing float. They kind of have a hard time floating bars. They kind of, the DNR and the Army Corps of Engineers and Fish and Wildlife, there are so many agencies that work on the river. They all have a problem with bars on the river, but fishing floats are kind of okay because that's providing access for people to fish. So that was originally, let's say, more of a fishing float than a bar, and I think it became more of a bar. But it's really a cool place, and they used to have a wet T-shirt contest in the summer. I don't think they still do that, but there were just, you wouldn't believe the crowd of people that
would bring. Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
It's kind of a wild place.
Well, you talk about transformations, and I think the transformation of Soldiers Grove, that story is always worth reading about, and that really was a transformation.
Yeah, that's one of those situations, and that happened in Prairie du Chien, too, on an island in the Mississippi River, where the community was suffering some terrible floods, and of course, they wanted the Army Corps of Engineers to build a dike around the community, as the community on the island at Prairie du Chien did. And then the Corps said, well, it's going to cost X million dollars to build the dike, and the whole town is worth half of that. And it's cheaper just to move everybody, you know, up the hill or away. Fortunately, the timing there at Soldiers Grove was such that people were just starting to get interested in solar energy, and they kind of made a deal because the city was part of raising the money, too, and there were various grants and sources for the money. But the condition was that any business that received assistance had to get a large share of its heating from solar energy. So this is in the late 70s. There are all these towns that were built up on the hill above the former site of the city on the Kickapoo River, and they all had big solar panels facing south. So it was quite a big deal for quite a while, and in that has become such an important issue now again, getting renewable energy. I thought it would be fun to revisit it and see how they're doing and kind of give readers an idea of what they'd see if they stopped by there. It's kind of a picturesque place, and that whole Kickapoo Valley is very interesting. And they were fortunate enough that the town was moved up the hill intact, whereas St. Farrell Island by Prairie du Chien, which is in the Mississippi River, that was kind of sad because that was probably the oldest neighborhood in Prairie du Chien, and a lot of the families went back to the French Canadians that came down there from Quebec and so on a couple hundred years ago. And when they moved that community, they kind of busted it up a lot. They still have a reunion and a Facebook page and kind of keep tabs on each other, but it was really a tight community of most of them were river rats. A lot of them made their living from the river.
And we need to take a quick look at the news, Reggie, so hang in there. We'll be back with more about the Mississippi River with Reggie McCroud right after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. Fortunate in Wisconsin to be near, no matter where you live, you're probably fairly near a lake or a river. And today we're talking about the biggest river, the Mississippi, with our guest today, Reggie McCloud, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Maybe you remember when the city of Soldiers Grove moved. Maybe your community was involved in lead mining in its history. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Questions about the communities along the Mississippi or the river itself, I hope you'll join us. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question and photo on our Facebook page. If you've got a photo of one of the communities or the Mississippi itself, we'd love to see that as well. Just put it up on our Facebook page. And Reggie, I mentioned lead mining, and you have a story about lead mining in your magazine.
Yeah, lead mining that's another industry that's kind of disappeared. But there are still a lot of artifacts from it. Lead mining was very important to the area in southwestern Wisconsin and Galena, Illinois, and Dubuque. Actually, Dubuque was named after a French-Canadian entrepreneur who came down there and started mining and sending the lead down the river to St. Louis. And there was a boom in that area it started in the 1830s. And in fact, Wisconsin is called the Badger State because a lot of these lead miners were in such a hurry to make their fortune mining lead that they just dig a little hole in the hillside and live in that like a badger. So that became a nickname for Wisconsinites because of the lead mining.
And it was used in so many things, so many products.
Well, yeah, it was used in bullets and shot, for cannon shot, kind of grape shot. In fact, one of the things the story talks about are these shot towers that were in place. There's still one in Dubuque where they would drop the molten lead through screens that would break it up into smaller chunks, kind of globules that would then cool in water. They'd have a pan of water at the bottom, and that's what they used for the lead shot in cannons. And you have names like Galena, Illinois, is named after the mineral that contained the lead that they were mining. And Potosi, Wisconsin, which is really an interesting town, was just riddled. It's a long valley. Most of it's in this long valley that goes right down to the Mississippi River. And it's named after a mountain in Bolivia, that has been mined for hundreds of years for silver and gold and all kinds of minerals. And that whole long valley that's, I think it's at least a mile long, had lead mines all into the sides of the hill all the way down. And then they built a long causeway kind of out into the river, and they had like a railroad track down there. They could load mine on it. They could load the lead on a car and take it down the hill and out on the river to load onto the riverboats out there. And there are mines.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was extremely important. But when we were talking about writing the story, I said, I don't want this just to be a history story. I want to list places that people can visit and see some things like the Shot Tower. There's a big valley near Dubuque called in the Mines of Spain State Recreation Area. And it's a very scenic, rocky valley, but it's actually where all the stone had been excavated for lead mining. I mean, it looks natural. It is so huge. And there are mines that you can actually go down into and visit, and a number of museums. And so there's a lot of things to do. And Mineral Point is a good site. We talk about a number of sites in Mineral Point. And so it's kind of a things to do story as well as a history story.
It definitely is. And Verona, up next with a question for you. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. I was wondering if you would talk at all about logging, how important the log rafts were that came down that were dropped off at all the cities, all the towns that had any way of milling the logs, particularly in Dubuque. You talked about the shot tower that has spent most of its life actually as a lookout for fires, because they had 14 sawmills in that part of town.
Very interesting. A comment about the logging industry.
Yeah, but it was so huge and so busy that I was just talking to someone about this recently. The largest source of pollution in the river for decades was sawdust. And there were sawdust islands in the river. And the riverfront in La Crosse, I mean, it's totally been transformed, but I remember back in the 70s, it was kind of all undeveloped and fields and open, and that was still where those sawmills had been, and they got knocked down and nothing replaced them for quite a while. And yeah, these log rafts were, you know, over 1,000 feet long, and they'd have, at first they just floated them down, and guys would be on there with long sweep oars and they would steer them, but they'd take advantage of the current. And the only place where they used riverboats for a while was in Lake Pepin, because the lake there was so broad that there wasn't enough current to push the log rafts through. So they'd get a boat to push them down to the bottom there, and then they'd just float and steer them, and eventually it was riverboats. And then they were so big they'd have to have a riverboat on the front of the raft that was attached to it sideways, and it could back up or go forward to steer the raft to point it in the right direction.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, and it was a rough. The guys that worked on those log rafts were had a reputation for being a pretty rough bunch. When they dropped the raft off at some town, they had some money in their pockets, and they'd get pretty wild.
It spent millions of board feet of lumber.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was, they cut those forests in a few decades, actually. It's kind of a tragedy, but that's kind of what built the West. And, yeah, Clinton, Iowa, Winona, Dubuque, a lot of these towns were really built with lumber money, and that's why in a lot of these towns, some of the nicer buildings you see were built in the 1880s or 1890s. The downtowns will have a lot of nice, fancy buildings, and there's still some old courthouses and so on, because, you know, there were a lot of millionaires in that industry. And Boise Cascade and some of the big international lumber companies, Weyerhaeuser, were actually started in these towns in Clinton, Iowa, and Winona and La Crosse.
Yeah.
And they're still going.
Yep, still going. Thanks, V, for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's where to go. Laura Ingalls Wilder has a special place, I think, in many people's hearts here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us about the event that takes place in Pepin each fall?
Well, Laura was born just outside of Pepin. And every September, they have Laura Ingalls Wilder's Day there. And they celebrate her life. And actually, there are still some of the descendants of her family that live in the area. But, you know, they have a lot of events and contests and so on that are kind of reenactments to kind of show appreciation and to remember how people did things there, how the first settlers survived, how they built houses and dressed and lived, and to celebrate that lifestyle. It was for a while wildly popular with Japanese people, because Laura Ingalls Wilder is very popular in Japan. I think that has calmed down a little bit, but there used to be huge tour groups from Japan that would come there for that celebration.
That is really something. According to Captain Ted Peck, perch seem to have made a nice recovery in the Mississippi. Have you found this true also?
Yeah, you know, I have to admit I haven't caught any. recently, I grew up on the Great Lakes, and most of the fish I caught were perch, and I've only caught a few in the river. But the last couple of years, people are catching all these perch that are, they call them footballs, because they're so fat, they're kind of shaped like footballs. And I'm going to go down fishing with Captain Ted here one of these days soon, and he's going to help me catch some myself. But it's interesting, because it was kind of unusual to catch perch on the river, and it is such a complex ecosystem. A few years ago, there was this huge explosion of I shouldn't call them weeds. I should call them submergent aquatic vegetation. But there were a lot of weeds growing in the river, and it was so bad you couldn't fish in a lot of places. And marinas had a hard time staying open, because they'd the loose ones would just sweep into the marina, and they were always trying to clean them off. And it was for the whole summer, for a good stretch of the river from about Lake Pepin down into Iowa a bit. And after that, I think the fishing improved a lot. And I suspect, and this is just my personal theory, that that had something to do with the perch, because those weeds provide shelter for bugs that the fish eat, and they also provide shelter for the small young fish. And I think that as bad as that was for recreation and fishing that summer, I think in the long run it really helped the fish and some of the other critters in the river a lot.
Dave in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I kind of walked in the middle of your conversation, and you were talking about the shot towers, and it occurs to me that there's a state park in Wisconsin that still has a shot tower as part of it. And I don't remember the name of the park. I wanted to say Tower Hill, but I don't.
It's Shot Tower Hill.
Shot Tower Hill? Okay.
State park, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew there was a state park. We've been there years ago. I haven't been there, but, you know, the signage and things, and they still had a tower there. I think it's on the Wisconsin River, so people could go and see that as well.
I remember going there for my eighth grade class trip.
I was probably older than eighth grade, but it's been many years since I've been there.
And talk about the view from the top of that place.
Yeah, and we talk about there, and there's also a pretty big museum in, gosh, I'm trying to remember the town in Wisconsin. I haven't been there yet. But
somebody will know it.
Oh, it's in the story. I'm looking at the story here. Oh, gosh. How embarrassing. My goodness.
Oh, that's all right. People can read the magazine and they'll find out.
Scholesburg.
There you go.
Yes. And they have a big museum, and I've heard great things about it. And, there's quite a few interesting places to visit where you can see things like that.
Mike in La Crosse has something for us. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Larry. The reason I'm calling is you were talking about the sawdust islands out in the river. I'd never heard of that before, but here in the city, a lot of the areas were filled in low areas, both with the sand from that was dredged out of the river, but also with sawdust. And a lot of places, people have reoccurring problems with termites in their home, and they can beat them back with the insecticides. But what I've been told is that because all the sawdust that's below the surface, that they can just remain alive down below down there. And then anyway, you'll beat them back in one place, put a barrier around a house, but then they'll pop up someplace else.
You're absolutely right. La Crosse is one of the areas of the state where we actually have termites, as you say, Mike. They're not everywhere, but the sawdust, Reggie probably had a big thing to do, as Mike's saying, had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't heard that about the termites. I know that in a lot of these places in the riverfront, when they knocked down the sawmills and then they started to develop them, they usually do borings in the soil before they build things to kind of find out what's going to happen if you put a lot of weight in it. And they often find a lot of sawdust there, and you really don't want to build on sawdust because it's going to slowly decompose over the years and your building's going to start sinking. So that's an issue on the Winona's Riverfront and La Crosse, but I had never heard about the termites. I mean, that's interesting to think of a whole population of termites living underground like that, waiting to come up and eat people's houses. I mean,
you'll have to give a call to Phil Pelletieri or PJ Leash at our insect diagnostic lab. You probably got a good story there, Reggie.
Yeah, we're going to have to do that story. That sounds fascinating.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Don in Eau Claire, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm not a Wisconsin native. I've lived here, though, about 65 years. But about 15 years or so ago, there was a story of a big boulder that broke loose from a cliff and rolled down the hill at Fountain City, went through the roof of a house there, into the house. No one, I think, was critically injured. And it was the family, I think, later moved out, and it was used as sort of a just something, a tourist site, that sort of thing. I wondered how big the boulder was and whether it still exists.
That's still there, and the tourist site is still open as far as I know. And it's called Rock in the House, which I kind of like that. It compliments House on the Rock. And it's just on the north end of Fountain City, overlooking the Army Corps of Engineers boatyard, and it's huge. It's gosh, it's at least 8 feet across, and it's interesting. I think it killed a woman. I think it landed on the bed in the bedroom, and the house is still intact, and the boulder is still where it landed. And I was going to make a joke, but I won't. And it's amazing. And in fact, I was just, and last week I was fishing. I caught a bunch of northerns, but no perch. But we were driving by there. A friend of mine from Madison was out visiting, and you always go around and have fun and see the sights when someone from out of town visits.
Sure.
And we drove by there, and my friend John said, oh, I remember when we brought our boys by there a couple years ago when we visited. And these guys were teenagers, and they were so bored with everything. You know, they were kind of rolling their eyes. They were that age. And we were driving by there, and I said, oh, let's go look at the Rock in the House. And those guys were fascinated. That's the most excited I've ever seen them as teenagers, was in that place taking pictures of that Rock in the House and standing next to it. It only cost $1 or $2 to stop in and see it, and it is pretty cool. And when you drive down the river, there are a lot of big rocky bluffs and a lot of houses below them. And you see these rocks, kind of big cracks and things. And that rock, when it first hit the house, shortly after that, I walked up the hill. I was following the path up the hill. And a friend of mine owned the house next door to it. And that rock was coming down the hill, and it took a big bounce and went to the left and hit this house. If it had gone to the right at about the same angle, it would have landed in my friend's house.
So it's wow.
Yeah. It's, boy, I'll tell you, it's like lightning, you know. Things like that can just happen.
Oh, Don, thank you for calling. Let's go to Dan in Plymouth next. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you were talking about Shot Hill State Park just a couple minutes ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, this is about 30 years ago. My wife and I were in the area touring around, and we ran across this park, so we thought we'd go see it, and we climbed up, and there was nothing really around there yet besides a parking lot, and on top there was like an old barn, I guess, that they used for working their shot, and or hot lead, whatever. And we were all alone, and we were looking over this stone wall, and down into the river, you know, but it must be about 100-foot drop, maybe.
Yeah.
And I says to my wife, do you love me? And she got real red in her face, and she made an about turn, and she walked real fast down the hill. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
Oh,
I have to remember that.
There you go. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. You know, we're got a minute and a half or so to go here, but I really enjoyed the piece as well on water, on the river, and making the river safe to drink.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly
really interesting about how the river changes, and, you know, the Every hour, there may be a different kind of chemical or whatever, or something different coming down. So the process of making it clean is something else.
Yeah, it's really tricky and complex. And when Pam wrote that, she just kept finding out stuff. It was amazing to get a tour of some of these plants. And it was kind of fun that at several of them, not just the one in Minneapolis, it's actually living mussels that are kind of the first line of defense. They run that water through kind of an aquarium full of mussels, and if there's something wrong with the water, they'll clam up, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they have detectors wired to them so they can tell if they all clam up all of a sudden, they're going to go, whoa.
Something's wrong.
There's
here.
There's a problem here. But much, yeah. It's unbelievably complex.
Well, I tell you, how do people get copies of your magazine?
Well, our website is at bigrivermagazine.com, and we list pretty much all of the places you can buy it. And actually, we're in some stores in Madison now, as well as in most of the river towns. Or you can call us at 1-800-303-8201 and subscribe on the phone. You can subscribe online through our website. And it's in most of the libraries in river towns, too. So we're trying to make it easy.
Well, Reggie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Larry. I always enjoy it.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Isn't it fun to talk about the history of the river and what's going on, and not only the history, but the present, and maybe a little about the future as well. So we'll have him back, and we'll do this again. Tomorrow we'll talk about baby birds with an artist who wrote a book about them, so I hope you can join us for that. Stay with us, though. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.